Good morning and welcome to Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. In a recent appearance on Capitol Hill, U.S. Interior Secretary Ken Salazar admitted that his agency was partly to blame for the disastrous ongoing oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. He also promised changes that would give the agency that regulates offshore drilling more tools, more resources, more independence, and greater authority. Today on Focus, in this hour, we'll be looking at regulatory issues in the Gulf oil spill. What were the failures and how can they be addressed? And our guest for the program is Mark Davis. He is Senior Research Fellow and Director of the Institute on Water Resources Law and Policy at Tulane University Law School. He's been there at Tulane since January of 2007. Before that, he served as Executive Director of the Coalition to Restore Coastal Louisiana, where he helped shape programs and policies at both the state and federal levels to improve the stewardship of wetlands and waters of coastal Louisiana. He has also practiced law in Indianapolis, in the District of Columbia, and Chicago, and has taught at Indiana University, Indianapolis, at the School of Business there, and also the IIT Chicago-Kent School of Law in Chicago. He has lectured widely on the topic of water resource management and stewardship. He's testified many times before Congress on the need for focused and effective commitment to the viability of coastal Louisiana and other vital natural treasures. And he's joining us this morning by phone. We're pleased to have him with us. Questions are welcome, too, as always. We ask people to be brief with their questions, but questions are welcome. In Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455. We have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us. 800-222-9455. Also, you may email your questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. Mr. Davis, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
It's a pleasure. After that introduction, I'm not sure we have time for any calls.
Well, I wanted to have an opportunity for people to get a sense of your background here, and I know sometimes maybe I go on a little bit too long.
Oh, I love hearing about myself.
Well, we certainly appreciate you giving us your time. As I said, just in recent appearance there in Congress, the Interior Secretary said, in fact, that his agency was partly to blame. And we also know that there at the end of May, the head of the Minerals and Mining Service, that Minerals Management Service that oversees offshore drilling, quit. Even though she'd only been on the job, I think, for not even a year, Liz Birnbaum. So maybe to start, I'll just ask the basic question. Do you, in fact, think that what happened here was a failure due to a failure of regulation?
Certainly that was one of the major contributing causes. That there were things going on the rig itself that I don't think Minerals Management Service had anything to do with. But the seeds for this disaster were sown quite some time ago, in my opinion anyway, when the practices that govern deep water drilling in particular were turned over to Minerals Management Service, and they really were focused more on being, I think, a cheerleader for getting oil and gas activity going in those waters, and took a lot of things on trust. And then Congress, which has a role in this as well, truncated the period of time that MMS had to, in fact, review permits to 30 days. Mm-hmm. So it was a domino effect of, I think, wishful thinking and, if you will, cheerleading policies that kind of brought us to this moment.
Well, let me ask you very specifically about one thing you just touched on. Now, apparently what the plan is, the Obama administration now is planning to extend that review period. It will now go from 30 days to 90 days, and that the hope is that will provide more time to do our potential environmental assessments and also assess the ability of companies to deal with something like this. Will that make how much difference do you think that will that make?
It can make a difference, but it only makes a difference if you really have the political will to say no or maybe to a permit application, and if you have the resources within the agency to make those decisions. I mean, quite frankly, the normal rule when you're applying our environmental laws, such as the National Environmental Policy Act, is that if you don't have a record that's complete enough to support saying yes, then you're supposed to say no, because your primary, these are regulatory programs, not permitting programs. But you know, I think it's important for people to realize that the Minerals Management Service is not primarily a regulator. It's primarily a revenue generator. And so the Minerals Management Service actually has a mission of producing, you know, dollars from the leasing of this nation's mineral wealth. And that's quite a, all you have to do is look at the budget today to realize that, you know, every dollar of revenue is something that the federal government really is trying to bring in. So it's an incredible tension, and I think that it is a really tough balancing act, and one that I don't think they've struck very well in recent memory. It's not just in the last few years.
Well, this seems to be an historic problem when you look at government agencies that are charged with resource management. And it seems that going back into, maybe going back into the 19th century or maybe the early 20th century, that environmental preservation has never really been that high on the list. It seems that the thing that was always, when these agencies were started, many of them, they were started with the intention that they were supposed to help exploit the resource and not protect it. And it seems that that's that kind of way of thinking. We haven't really quite grown out of that all these many years later.
I think that's a very fair point. And I think even as we develop more of an environmental sensitivity and our understanding of the complexity of the environment around us grows, it doesn't necessarily change the policies and programs or even agency cultures that had been put in place before. I think a great example is is coastal Louisiana, where if your listeners aren't very familiar with it, Illinois helped build it because all of the sediments that come out of the Mississippi River system, and a lot of that's Illinois, found their way to the mouth of the Mississippi River over the last 7,000 years and built essentially a four million acre delta complex. And that has been carved up for oil and gas, other mineral resources, navigation, and a whole bunch of things. And it's essentially an imploding delta. But those things were done largely at a time when wetlands were considered wastelands. It was actually policy at the state and federal level to do anything you could to put them to some productive commercial use. When we passed the Clean Water Act and a few other laws, we shifted that perspective, and most people now, I think, view wetlands as being very important. But it doesn't mean all those things we did before suddenly went away. Mm-hmm. So we actually have to, if we will start getting honest about facing the past that is still very much part of our present, if we're going to get serious about better stewardship. And I think it's not so much a question of saying no to oil and gas or no to certain activities. I think it's really, are we going to be honest about the complexities and costs of doing those things?
Just something that I was struck by, I guess I didn't really realize this, but that of the 30, something like 30%, and you can correct me if I have this wrong, but something like 30% of U.S. oil production comes from offshore wells, and by far the vast majority of those wells are in the Gulf of Mexico.
That's very true, and interestingly, that at some point those wells, which aren't just sitting out there by themselves, they're hooked up to a pipeline complex that comes ashore for the most part in Texas and Louisiana, and that's where this country gets a lot of its oil, and not only the oil that we produce, but that which is shipped in. And that those pipelines are also embedded in the barrier islands, the wetlands, and things like that. So when you start losing those wetlands, you start losing those barrier islands, you start having a much more vulnerable energy supply, and you're also creating the potential for more frequent and more catastrophic accidents, spills and such. And so it's a dynamic environment, and if you do not take the time to understand it, then you're living by hope, but you're not really exercising much in the way of prudent governance.
Yeah. Well, I guess the other thing that then, and I suppose this is a dilemma, particularly for people in that region, is that there are an awful lot of people who are dependent for their livelihood on the oil industry. And it seems that I was really, again, struck by hearing people in Louisiana talk about the fact that essentially they had two industries, one that had to do with the water, so that was commercial fishing and sport fishing, and the other was oil. And people there saying, look, you can't, yes, we have to deal with this, and we're bearing the brunt of it, but you also just can't shut down oil business in the Gulf, because if you do that, then there's going to be a big hole in the economy of those areas that surround the Gulf.
And that's very true, and that's what makes this, you know, such a tough thing to have to handle. That, and this wasn't a situation that was created by the Obama administration or our Jindal administration or any of the other, you know, existing governments at the Gulf South. I mean, this is just something that pretty much was a brick that had been hanging over everyone's head for a long time, and it finally fell. And now everyone has to figure out what to do. And it is very true that, you know, the economy not only of Louisiana but Texas and many, you know, local governments and families are dependent upon servicing that oil and gas industry. And it creates a very, if you will, a paradox where people's lives are endangered by the manner in which we have been pursuing oil and gas development, but at the same time, they're dependent upon it. Mm. And it's, in that sense, it's not too different than, you know, people who work in a factory where they, you know, they wish that there were better safety practices, they wish they had a greater voice in how things are done, but the last thing they want to see, at least in the next, in the near term, is for the factory to close. That they don't have a transition plan, and particularly in the Gulf South, which has had a series of jolting events over the last 5 years, with Hurricane Katrina and Hurricane Rita and several others, and then really the collapse of the national economy, which has exhausted a lot of the resilience that was otherwise there. Hmm. So it's not easy, that shouldn't be an excuse for not asking the right questions now and not starting to get your regulatory house in order. But this is those folks are as much victims of the sort of sleepwalking approach we've taken to managing the risks of this industry in the offshore environment, as any of the folks who are actually working on the rigs.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Mark Davis. He is Senior Research Fellow and Director of the Institute on Water Resources Law and Policy at Tulane University Law School. That's in New Orleans. And we're talking about the regulation of offshore oil drilling. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And you also can send your questions by email to will-talk@illinois.edu. One of the things that the Secretary Salazar said that he intended to do was to split up the responsibilities of the Minerals Management Service into three divisions. One would be responsible for collecting royalties, another would issue the leases, and a third would be responsible for doing the inspection on the rigs. Do you think that that makes sense and that that would be helpful?
I do think it makes sense, and I think it will be helpful, but until we see how it actually works, we won't know how much of an improvement it is, because the regulatory environment for this industry begins with the leasing. That's when you do the environmental impact statements and the like, and there I can attest from my personal involvement to the severe discounting of risk that has been the practice not only of the industry but of the Minerals Management Service for really the last as far back as I've been working on it, which is about 20 years. And in fact, it got to the point where in 2006, after Hurricane Katrina, the state of Louisiana, as dependent as it is on oil and gas, actually sued the Minerals Management Service to block a lease, saying that the environmental assessments hadn't been, you know, updated sufficiently to take into account the real risks to the communities and the environments of South Louisiana. And the Minerals Management Service, you know, supported by the American Petroleum Institute, contested that vigorously. And the case was settled, but not before you had a federal judge who said, I think that you should settle because I believe if this goes to trial, there's a good chance that the state will prevail on the merits and that it will be able to show that you were, in fact, arbitrary and capricious in how you were assessing these risks. But at that point, the Minerals Management Service was very clearly saying that either, you know, Louisiana has been complicit for so long that you really can't bring up new issues now, and also that this nation needed the money so badly that to delay a lease sale for any of these considerations would be a catastrophe for national defense and the national economy. I mean, that was happening on the leasing end. That wasn't on the rig safety end, and that was not on the royalty collection. So if you don't start scoping the risks adequately on the front end, you shouldn't be surprised when the guys, you know, inspecting the rigs on the back end aren't looking at the things that they need to look at.
Hmm. Well, what about the guys who are inspecting the rigs? There seem to be some questions about whether, in fact, the Minerals Management Service was doing the inspections that it was supposed to do.
Well, again, I haven't been out on those rigs and the like, but I can tell you that the record that I have seen that's being developed is certainly very troubling. That not only because I think, you know, it's nice when, you know, people actually do their jobs, but as we saw in this situation, when you get it wrong in these environments, people pay with their lives, and they pay with their livelihoods, and that, you know, this isn't a matter of technical, you know, non-compliance being punished. When you get things wrong in these very complex environments, and these rigs are really remarkable, you know, technological achievements, and the people who work on them, you know, work in an environment that most people in the United States, you really can't imagine. It's almost more akin to a space station where it's that autonomous, but it needs to be supplied by, you know, an Earth link. That I think there really is a duty to put safety and public interest first. That's, again, not to say that you can't get this stuff out of the ground and bring it to market, but I think what we're seeing right now, and I think this is where the regulatory program really got off base, was that they didn't realize that they were effectively subsidizing that activity with the lives and the livelihoods and the environmental well-being, and that even though major disasters are rare, they do happen. Hmm. They happened in off the Australian coast earlier this year. We've had them in 1979 in the Bay of Campeche here in the Gulf of Mexico. These things can happen, and when they do happen, you know, they're very, very bad. And at that point your options are poor. And that's why I think the regulatory environment should not be focused on, you know, the technicalities of what's going on, but fundamentally the purpose of running a safe and environmentally secure operation. And I don't think, from what I have seen, that, you know, was the practice at MMS. And I think there's an entire culture that needs to be revisited. It was already been made very clear from the congressional hearings that they didn't even know, that some of the folks didn't even know what their own regulations were, and that's no way to run a shop.
Yeah. We have a caller. Others are welcome. Let's go to Piatone for someone here on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. You know, this whole thing, I'm thinking right now conspiracy theory. I haven't heard one iota how or why it blew up. It's like, you know, I never heard anything about any investigation whatsoever on how they're going to, you know, find out why it happened. In some cases, I've heard stories about, well, maybe the environmentalists blew it up on purpose to prove a point. I don't know if that's true, and I know from what I understand, I've heard and read about, it sounds like, you know, the maintenance factor was a big cause. But, you know, here's the problem we have. Until we get off of driving cars entirely, we'll never get off the oil binge. And until we can charge people $9 or $10 or $20 a gallon for gas, it'll force the issue to get people out there, car manufacturers and other people, to at least get some kind of, you know, transportation mode other than oil. And I do have a diagram at home that shows that gasoline and oil, as far as car consumption, was a small portion of what we use as far as, you know, doing that. A lot of it has to do with plastics and, you know, chemicals and other things. But the point I'm trying to make here is that, you know, as long as humans are around, we're not perfect. We're infallible. We make mistakes. And until we stop, and I think, to be honest with you, the oil company has a pretty good record because this is the first it's happened in a long, long time. You know, I think it's pretty good. NASA's another one. Now, I know this is kind of off topic in a way, but we lost two shuttles. But you look at the whole entire world and how many times they've tried to blast things off. You know, how many people have they killed versus our guys? I guess we're all going to be apt to mistakes. It's to minimize the mistakes and get people on board. And I think the big problem we have is our Congress and their Senate allowing this to happen, because we all know that they all get paid by the big corporations. And, you know, Obama going down and making a speech and doing it isn't doing anybody any good. I quite frankly don't see why we didn't have some kind of organization, you know, maybe it's the Coast Guard, to have all this stuff ready.
Yeah,
I mean, one thing I couldn't understand. But
you've laid an awful lot out for us on the table there that we can talk about. I do think that it is the case that there is going to be an investigation into the cause of the accident, but first of all, so that at some point we should actually have a pretty good idea what happened. I think, though, that there is some suspicion that what happened, that this was a failure when the sealing of the well was taking place, and that we had a gas explosion. Is that, and maybe you know more about this, and I expect you know more about this than I do.
Well, again, the investigation is ongoing, but I think a number of things have been ruled out, including, you know, sabotage by environmentalists or anybody else, that by and large this was a situation where, in the course of plugging the well, and this was an exploratory well. This was not a well that was producing gas and oil. And the practice is you go drill the well, then you plug it, and then you bring in your production facility to start collecting the oil. And so this was at the end of that first phase of drilling the well, so it would one day be, you know, hooked up to the supply, to essentially a pumping rig. And in doing that, in part because they were behind schedule, and it costs a lot of money to have a crew out there and have these rigs, and these rigs are in short supply, that some decisions were made to, if you will, push the engineering envelope and to do things that were not standard. And, you know, at least it appears that, you know, In that process, the plugging process failed. Essentially, they removed drilling muds that are used to prevent gas and oil from coming up. And yes, what we had was essentially a burst of gas coming up when it hit the surface. There are a lot of hot things there. It explodes, and then it's trouble. And then that's different from the spill. The spill happens when essentially the rig falls over. You break the pipe, and then the containment system fails. Now, there are a couple of points the caller makes that I think are worth us taking a minute on. This country, you know, the Coast Guard does not have a bunch of drilling rigs. It doesn't have tankers, and it doesn't have a bunch of petroleum geologists on their staff. And it's our practice under the oil pollution law that was put in place after the Exxon Valdez to essentially put the responsible party in charge of fixing the problem that they created. Doesn't matter why, you know, if they were careless or just unlucky. The fact is you have a responsible party, and their job is to stop the oil because they have the relationships with the people in the industry, and they should have the technology available to do what needs to be done, first and fastest. That's an assumption. I think there's going to be a robust discussion as to whether or not that's, in fact, something we can rely upon. But irrespective, you had none of these things at the ready. The boom wasn't at the ready. The containment caps weren't at the ready. The fire boom wasn't ready. And in some countries, not the United States, they require the drilling of a relief well simultaneously with the exploratory well. We don't do that. So our response time is not measured in days, but in weeks and months. So that's how we get into the mess from the standpoint of who's handling this. But this White House didn't have the technology and the personnel at their fingertips, neither did the Bush administration, the Clinton administration, or anybody before, and neither did any of the governors. So whether we like it or not, most of the expertise lies with the industry right now. And if we want to change that, we're going to have to make it a plan to do that. With respect to the issue of, as long as we're essentially in a society that consumes oil and gas, we're going to run these risks. That's absolutely true. And I would also agree that, as long as we have, gas at the prices that we like to pay it. I mean, I like, paying $1.25 for gasoline, not $4. But as we can see right now, there are costs that come with that. If you want to have a relief well that's drilled simultaneously, that will add to the cost of oil and gas. If you want to have containment facilities at the ready, that will add to the cost of oil and gas. And all of those things will happen, and in places in the world where they do require those things, fuel is more expensive. That's what I was saying, that we have effectively been subsidizing the production of our oil and gas with, essentially the economies and cultures and the environment up to a point. And again, with something like this, which is very improbable, but certainly foreseeable, and when it does happen, it is catastrophic. That's when you start, there's a line there between what, I don't think you can blame the folks who drive their cars for what may be negligence on a rig. You have to have well-managed facilities, and you have to have good policies if you want to ultimately get to a place where you're being the best steward you can be. So I think it's important not to blame everybody for what's going on in the Gulf. But in the long term, if we really want to have environmental and energy policies that lead to better choices, well, then that probably we will have that conversation about how we drive, where we drive, and what we use our energy sources for.
We're a little bit past our midpoint here. Let me introduce again the guest, Mark Davis. He is Senior Research Fellow and Director of the Institute on Water Resources Law and Policy at Tulane University Law School in New Orleans. He's been there at Tulane since the beginning of 2007. Before that, he served 14 years as Executive Director of the Coalition to Restore Coastal Louisiana. He's practiced law in Indianapolis, in D.C., and in Chicago, also taught at Indiana University Indianapolis at the School of Business and the IIT Chicago-Kent School of Law in Chicago. And we're talking about regulation of offshore oil drilling, so questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. You send your emails also to will-talk@illinois.edu. Here's another caller in Urbana, here where we are, and that's line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
First of all, I want to say thanks for addressing the activist theory. I think that both the caller and the guest, I appreciate that because, it just seems to me it's almost like saying that activists would go out and start a forest fire to prove that clear cutting a forest is bad. It just doesn't make sense, to cause something at that scale to fail, to prove a point. That just is kind of ridiculous. But the other thing I wanted to ask, and I'll hang up after I've asked so I can hear the answer, is during this big ongoing investigation, you know, I've been hearing things about the safety, head safety manager and the BP head who were on the rig arguing during their morning meeting or whatever, safety meeting. And I guess I'm just wondering what has come of that, you know, what information has come out from that. And also, is anything being done to track, say, memos, letters from above this guy who's the head of BP to, you know, see how the culpability line goes, you know, if it comes from the head guy, if it comes from, you know, his underlings, whoever it comes from. You know, I think once you start holding people accountable in high places, things change. And when you stop doing that or you just don't care because it's all about the almighty dollar, you get nothing but what's, you know, status quo. So anyway, I'll hang up and listen to your answers.
Thank you.
Well, I think there's going to be a long and pretty robust squabble over exactly who did what and who is truly liable for this. And I'm not, other than the things that are coming out in the hearings and some of the investigative journalism, I'm not seeing anything really that you and your callers haven't seen. And I think what's one thing that we should expect is this is going to, we're about to enter the litigation phase of this, because even though, you know, BP has been very forthright in saying, look, we are responsible, and we'll pay every legitimate claim, that's not the same thing as saying admitting that they are liable for all the damages. Under the Oil Pollution Act, the responsible party, and that is unquestionably BP here, has certain responsibilities to pay for damages, but if they can find someone else who made a mistake, they can shift that responsibility onto them. And that's kind of what we've seen with BP pointing the finger at Halliburton and at Cameron and Transocean and other, you know, players in this. We don't yet know how all that's going to go, and in part because lawyers don't, you know, tip their hands and they don't admit to things they don't have to admit. So we're going to, those memos, keep watching. You'll start to see them, but that could easily take years. And I think that's one of the things that worries a lot of the folks I know who are working on this, is that if this takes the normal course of a major spill, or in this instance where you actually have lots of property damage and even, you know, the deaths of workers, it can take years to sort these things out and to actually see significant dollars put into, you know, remediation and you know, the damages. And although BP has spent a lot of money up to this point, most of its money has been spent on just containing this system and this leak. It hasn't gone to fixing it. We're not to that stage yet, and that's really where the dollars are going to go up. That's where the exposure is great. And we're already seeing information starting to be held much more closely. So it's going to be even harder, I think, for people to understand where this is going, which is why I do think, and I don't know what the president's going to say tomorrow night, but I hope what he's going to say is at least this, is that, you know, we're going to make sure that all of the information is obtained as quickly as possible, and we are going to not rely exclusively on BP to tell us what is going on. We are going to have our own independent ability to tell you what the flows are, what the damages are, this, that, and the other, because otherwise you are reliant on somebody whose self-interest is in actually not letting that information out.
Just what seems to make this more complicated, again, as I understand it, is in an operation like this, you have several parties who were involved. There is the lease owner, mm-hmm. Then there is the operator who does the planning for the operation. Then there are service companies, and they're the ones who do the actual drilling and then also, you know, provide other kind of services to the rig. The lessee is the only party that actually has a direct relationship with the government.
Mm-hmm.
And it, one wonders, well, is that really the best way to structure this? Or maybe that's just the standard in an industry like this and in others.
Well, and that is actually fairly standard. And, not only are these rigs, owned by someone other than BP, these are all essentially, ships. These are considered vessels under maritime law. They're mostly not even registered under, they're not even U.S. flagged vessels. So these become, very complex questions of choice of laws, maritime laws, environmental law, personal injury, property damage law, state law versus federal law, incredibly complex relationships, which most of the time, we're all spared the pain of having to understand. But when it does go wrong, as we see here, in order to understand where this is going, we are going to have to take the time to school ourselves a little bit in, what the legal architecture is, because it's easy to think that this is all a conspiracy when it works in such an arcane way, but, that's in fact the architecture that we live with.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not too different, when you actually realize when you're sitting in a railroad crossing that whoever owns the engine is not necessarily the company that owns all the freight cars. Airplanes are often leased to airlines. And so you realize that it's not just a question of whose logo was on the thing. That doesn't tell you who owns it. It just really tells you who's using it, and it doesn't tell you whose people are operating it. That you really do have to inform yourself. And I think those are the kinds of policy discussions that we're probably going to have, and they're long overdue, on the heels of this. Things are going to change. Things will change dramatically. That doesn't mean they're going to improve or even dramatically or even improve much at all. And that's where I think an engaged citizenry is going to make a difference. That, this is not a Gulf Coast disaster. This is not a Louisiana problem. This is essentially a transformative moment in, I think, how, not only the United States, but I think others in the world are going to look at how they pursue energy, how they cost it, and what they're going to insist upon with respect to accountability and transparency. And I have my hopes in that. I hope we are much more accountable. I hope we are much more transparent, and I hope we're able to turn what is admittedly a very heavy regulatory environment into an effective regulatory environment. And but we don't know.
Another caller here, Spring Bay. This is line 4, the toll-free line. Hello.
Oh, good morning. Well, one of the things you keep kind of talking about or mentioning in your comments is complexity and the level of, it talks about energy return on energy invested and the level of complexity that we have to seem to keep ratcheting up in order to continue our current lifestyle is eventually a zero-sum game. I think that this Gulf oil mess is a wake-up call to that. Drilling in 5,000 feet of water, the Brazilians want to drill in 18,000 feet of water. We're taking tar sands out of Canada and melting it down. The age of easy, cheap oil is over. And the level of complexity that we're going to have to use to continue to maintain this is eventually going to come back to bite us. And I'll get off and listen to your comments. Thanks for the good show. Bye.
All right. Well, how can you respond, or do you have a response?
Well, yeah, I think the caller makes a very good point, and that is the days of relatively easy oil and gas are gone. We have largely gotten the oil and gas that was easy to get. That doesn't mean that there isn't oil and gas left out there, but it is in places that are hard to get, and it's They're in geologic formations that are not easy to get to. The tar sands the caller referred to is an excellent example. And it's one of the reasons I think this is a, whether people want it to be or not, is going to be a fairly transformative moment in how we decide where we get our energy. In the near term, we're still going to be heavily dependent on high carbon fuels, coal, oil, natural gas. Not just for fuel, but as an earlier caller noted, we use those things in our fertilizers. We use those things in plastics and in fabrics. We've become very dependent upon them. And I think what we have to do is really figure out where we want to go. And it's not just a simple matter of saying, let's all do, you know, solar, or let's all do hydropower, or let's move to natural gas and get off of oil. That's kind of a slogan level of planning. You actually have to think in terms of, well, where could you put these things and what are the elements? As we've seen, out west where there have been efforts to move toward greater solar, solar is often just a substitute for fuel. You know, you're using the sun instead of oil or coal. But beyond that, the technologies are still fairly standard. You're still producing electricity all too frequently by heating water and turning turbines and the like, and water is a scarce commodity in much of this country, and it's becoming more so. And that's one of the other reasons I think people should anticipate we're going to continue, in all likelihood, to look for oil and gas in places like the Gulf of Mexico and elsewhere, not because we want to, but for two reasons. First of all, it's such a big chunk of revenue to the federal treasury that if you didn't do it, you'd have to look at other taxes, and people don't like that. And secondly, because it is relatively an easier thing to do. If you look at where the tar sands, and if you look at the oil and gas, like we have in the Haynesville Shale in northeast Texas and northwest Louisiana, the Marcellus Shale in Pennsylvania and New York, and you have these shale formations in Colorado. You have abundant supplies of, in particular, natural gas, but it's locked up in rock, and you fracture that rock using water. And water is a limiting factor on so much of this. So it's not a question of do we have the reserves, do we have ready access to them, and at what cost. So I think we are going to have that conversation, and I think it's already starting. And I think people are going to be become much more conversant with how, when, and where we get the fuels that we choose to use to, make life as we know it possible. I mean, I remain an optimist that we still have a fair number of options at our disposal. But I'm not deluding myself into thinking that that's going to be easy or costless. There are going to be winners and there are going to be losers. And I think as we're looking here in the Gulf South, Some of these communities and some of these cultures may never be the same. In all likelihood, won't be.
About 5-6 minutes left in this hour of focus. Mark Davis is our guest. He is a senior research fellow and director of the Institute on Water Resources Law and Policy at Tulane University in New Orleans. We're talking about offshore oil drilling and the regulation of the industry. Questions welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Something else, and I don't know if this is getting too narrow, but it's my understanding that things like design standards for wells and platforms and pipelines, these sorts of things, they're set by committees of engineers and scientists who work for the oil industry. So they're setting their own standards. And again, this may be something that is just typical of all industry, that they set their own standards. But particularly when it comes to devices that are supposed to try to help if there's a problem, fail-safe kind of devices, does it make sense, or would it make sense for the government to somehow be more involved in this?
I think government needs to be more involved, but it doesn't mean I would expect them to actually be designing these structures any more than I would expect them to design cars or buses. or even airplanes for that matter, that for the most part, you know, those are things that are handled by the people who, in fact, are in the business of building them. Also, these are things that are in, you know, global commerce. You know, you can take a rig from that's used in the Gulf of Mexico and you can move it to the coast of Africa in a matter of months, and they do that. Most of the rigs that we're using here are not manufactured in the United States, so it's not a matter of just having, you know, tough standards here. You know, as we saw after the Exxon Valdez, when the move toward double-hulled tankers was born, well, most of the tankers in the world aren't built in this country, and you can't actually come up with a standard that, you know, you can impose on that entire global community, particularly in, you know, in the near term. So I think government needs to be more involved so they'll know how best to protect the public interest and how best to be stewards of the resources that are theirs to be stewards of. But I do not expect them, and I don't think anybody fairly should expect them to be essentially, you know, designing the engineering specs and the operating protocols. And that's, again, that's one of the reasons that this is a tough regulatory environment, and if you're not clear about what you're regulating for, it's very hard to make sure that you're actually getting, you know, any useful result from the regulatory program on the back end.
All right. Now we have another caller here, Rockville, Indiana, line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I was wondering if you could discuss the other spill that happened this weekend. I really haven't heard much except for that there was one in Utah, the Chevron pipeline spill.
I don't know much about it other than there was a pipeline spill at Chevron, and again, it was a terrestrial thing. I haven't seen any discussion about what actually caused it, and I think people just, you need to know that these things happen. See, you know, wherever you have this stuff, there are either, you know, physical things that interfere, mistakes are made, spills are going to occur. And if you're not planning to avoid them, then you should expect them to happen more frequently. And if you're not planning to actually contain them and stop them promptly, which is what we see in the Gulf, they didn't actually have the proven technology that they swore that they did at the ready, then you can expect the consequences to be fairly severe. And the moment we start taking our essentially our energy choices as a matter of, you know, hope and or faith, then we're living at risk. And we shouldn't assume just because something didn't happen bad yesterday that it was because of our, you know, forethought and planning. I'd rather be smart than lucky in these matters, and we haven't
Indeed.
Been very smart.
Could it be a case of negligence like the BP line in Alaska where they didn't actually use their cleaning methods for 10 years unlike they were supposed to?
It could be, but again, I really don't know. I mean, there are a million things it could be, and I'm sure that if you follow the story, there'll be, you know, more information coming. But again, most of the information is initially going to come from the industry itself.
One last question, if I may.
Yes.
How much did the regulations change after Cheney had his closed-door talks with the oil companies and rewrote them all? And I'll take that off the air. Thank you.
The most significant change we saw, you know, during that period of time was the shortening of the period and the window within which MMS was to make a decision on a permit. That's where the 30-day rule came from. Since I don't know what was actually discussed in the closed-door meetings, I can't really draw too many connections between what was discussed there and what might have happened. I do know, for a brief period of time, I sat on the Minerals Management Service Outer Continental Shelf Advisory Committee, and I do know that there was a prevailing viewpoint that the environmental concerns and the concerns that states would express, like Louisiana ultimately did in 2006 in filing suit against MMS, were an unnecessary inconvenience. And then they were looking for ways to shorten the period of time for people to comment and to limit the rights of the public and of states to essentially get into the business of when leases were issued and what the terms and conditions of leases and drilling plans would be. That I can tell you from conversations I was personally part of. I think that the people that I was listening to and in those conversations with, they weren't bad people. I think that they had convinced themselves, first and foremost, that they knew best and that they, you know, in fact, had somewhere in their various organizations covered these bases. I think that, you know, it was a self-deception, perhaps, but it's one that I think none of us can afford to let happen again.
I did just very quickly also think that I did read that there was something, some particular piece of emergency equipment that might have prevented this this disaster from happening when the explosion occurred, and that back during the time that the caller's talking about, the oil company said to the administration, they said, well, look, we don't really think this is necessary, and in addition, it would be very expensive. It's something that actually is required other places, and in there are some places where it's voluntarily used, even by BP, and that in response to that, to the request by the company that it not be required, the administration said, well, okay, you don't need to do that.
And I think that, yes, there have been there's evidence of that. And when you look around the world, the one thing you will come to, at least I walk away with, and this is particularly important when you're working in environments where, you can affect, important public resources. And that's why I get involved, because these are all watery environments, and fish, freshwater drinking supplies, and a whole bunch of other things are implicated. But by and large, the standard that they will hit is the standard they are required to. There is no single industry standard around the world for doing these things. So a statement that, safety is our top priority, doesn't mean much in the absence of, standards you can judge it against. And when you look at the kind of spills that happened, off Australia earlier this year, if you look at how they handle things in the North Sea, if you look around the world and you do see the practice varies. And it's almost always driven by how can we reduce cost and save time. Mm-hmm. And I think that, that is really where we're going to see regulatory programs, at least in this country, I think, moving, is to restrike that balance and to not, take nearly so much, on the faith in the industry or the technology. Yeah.